Russia's Choice, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Vladimir Putin is a shoo-in for re-election as Russia's president next month. This man works for one of the other candidates.
This election is a fake. So in this type of reality, you don't have much of a choice. But you can try at least do something.
Also, a young man who was adopted from South Korea and raised by a white family in Pittsburgh rethinks his identity in the age of Trump.
Even though all the people that know me say, like, I'm pretty much white, I kind of stopped seeing myself that way because I realized I wasn't being treated that way.
Plus, why installing solar panels could leave customers in Colorado with higher utility bills.
I know, it makes, like, no sense.
Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on a Monday. Good to have you with us. The State Department has announced a plan to counter Russian election meddling in the U.S. midterms later this year. Congress ordered such a scheme last summer, and no doubt we'll be hearing more about the $40 million that's been allocated to the plan and what might actually be done to stop more Russian trolling before next November. But right now, a different take from a different time inside Russia. This turned out to be a pivotal moment for Russia's opposition. In late 2011 and 2012, tens of thousands of Russians took to the streets, fired up about election fraud and calling for clean government. Author Michael Idov was on the ground in Moscow then. Those protests feature prominently in his new book, Dressed Up for a Riot, Misadventures in Putin's Moscow. Idov says that at the time, the Kremlin came up with a simple explanation for the protests.
The answer, of course, was Hillary Clinton, then Secretary of State, must be fomenting disarray and confusion. And the problem with that is that, of course, the United States and the State Department and the CIA have, in fact, over the course of history, been instrumental in regime change. And so Putin, with his, you know, KGB mindset that suggests to him that there are only two powers in the world, Russia and the U.S., jostling for influence, he basically sees the entirety of the 90s as the U.S. grabbing more influence over Eastern Europe. So in his mind, even as extreme as, grabbing Crimea, they are seen as tit for tat. In his mind, the Ukrainian revolutions, both of 2004, the Orange Revolution, and of 2014, were directly inspired, if not directed, by the State Department. And it's very hard to argue with that. And actually, you know what didn't help? Also, people like Victoria Nuland and John McCain, who would go to Kiev and kind of showboat, egging on the protesters. It's funny because this is kind of a benevolent enthusiasm that America tends to have for freedom movements all over the world, which is often seen from another point of view as a malevolent meddling. So this is something that provides a kind of moral justification for Russia to meddle in American elections.
Well, let's go back to 2012. I want to hear from you what that actually felt like, because you write in your book, all of a sudden, Moscow teamed with post-grad do-gooders, each and everyone in the twinkly-eyed, what do you need, how can we help mode, the mode the rest of the world mistakes for malicious meddling, and that, in fact, is a kind of adolescent excitability mixed in with unconscious condescension. I love that description, but tell us what that Western do-gooder attitude actually looked like on the ground in Russia.
I've never felt myself to be part of the Russian, you know, freedom movement. I thought of myself as a sympathetic American observer, but then all these people that I ran into, they saw me as this, you know, oh, he's a progressive Russian editor, you know, a brave little freedom fighter. And it was funny to feel condescended to and patronized in that sense. And then kind of thinking, oh, so that's how the Russians actually feel. Wow. I mean, we Americans do talk down to them, because once they saw me, you know, in the context as a Russian magazine editor, it was literally like, oh, aren't you cute? How can we help you fight the bloody regime? And then, of course, the more you talk to these people, the more you realize that they don't have the fact. You're on the ground, and it's everything is much more nuanced than they think. So, yeah, it was very educational for me.
Was U.S. meddling in Russia in 2012 really that innocent?
In 2012 specifically, I would say yes. I mean, again, there was an excitement about things finally sort of shifting after so many years of political apathy. And there was a dash of hope that these middle-class protest movements would force the Kremlin to liberalize. And Putin came back and promptly began a sort of closing down all avenues for protest.
Yeah, I mean, this seems to be a lot on your mind. I mean, the final pages of your book, you conclude that Russia has suddenly gotten what it's wanted, the fear and the grudging respect. The West is finally as obsessed with Russia has always imagined it was. Do you recognize the Russia you've been seeing in American characterizations of Russia and Russians over the past year?
Sometimes, because some of it is based, some fantastic journalism has been done unraveling sort of this influence operation that that Russia has been trying to put together in order to kind of export its cynical vision of the world. On the other hand, of course, I don't recognize Russia whenever it's depicted in the West as a ruthlessly competent place, a place run by cynical technocrats who have gamed out every move 10 moves in advance, because that's just not true. You know, the Russian disinformation and influence efforts have always been haphazard and largely inept. It's just that they got incredibly lucky because their guy won. But, you know, in France, for example, the Russian bots and all these networks that we are supposed to be afraid of, they backed every candidate except Macron. Sometimes some of the reactions border on racism. Just today, actually, I saw a jokey tweet from somebody I respect a lot, you know, Jennifer Palmieri, the, you know, White House communications director under Obama. And her sort of joke tweet was that, you know, I'm in the San Francisco airport and I just got into a gypsy cab, it's unmarked, and it's driven by a Russian. So in case I disappear, it's a tan Lincoln Continental. And it's going back to the Boris and Natasha
kind of thing.
Right, exactly. It's very strange to sort of feel that way, but that is actually racism. Casual and jokey, but it is racism. And I wish we were able to acknowledge the facts of the Kremlin's sort of malevolent intent without making the conversation into some sort of a Cold War thing about godless communists or just generally caricaturing the other side. That would be nice.
Michael Idov is the author of Dressed Up for a Riot, Misadventures in Putin's Moscow. Thanks very much for being with us, Michael.
Thank you.
We'll have more of our interview with Michael Idov later this week about his editing GQ Russia and writing TV dramas there. Fascinating guy. This next story is also about someone with Russia connections who went back after honing his skills here in the U.S. Here's Charles Maines in Moscow.
It was nearly 10 years ago, back in the summer of 2008, that a certain junior senator from Illinois arrived in Berlin to a rock star reception.
And thank you to the people of Germany.
And there, somewhere among the crowd that day of nearly a quarter of a million people, was Vitaly Shklarov, a native of Belarus who'd moved to Germany for his studies. Vitaly says he was mesmerized by Barack Obama, or as mesmerized as he could be, given that he didn't understand a single word. See, Vitaly didn't speak English back then.
Zero. It was just optics. I didn't even understand. I was just like, wow, I got infected.
Vitaly describes a collision of worlds in his head that day. Watching the charismatic rising star of the Democratic Party, he couldn't help but contrast Obama with the gray politicians he'd seen back home in Belarus and as a kid growing up in the Soviet Union.
So just imagine you grew up listening to some brainwashed communist crap on TV. And then, you know, like, what's happening? Well, why does my country not have politicians or ideas like this? It's all Obama's fault.
In other words, says Vitaly, thanks, Obama. Inspired by that Berlin speech, Vitaly eventually made his way to the U.S., where he signed up as a volunteer for President Obama's 2012 re-election campaign.
I believe in you. I need you to keep believing in me. I want to finish the job. And if you're willing to stand with me and make some phone calls with me and knock some doors with me.
It was a dream come true, says Vitaly, or would have been if he hadn't been stuck dialing get-out-the-vote calls in a dank basement. And again, the problem, Vitaly's English. Better, but still shaky.
I just simply didn't understand what people were saying. Sir, can you please repeat it again? And they were like, okay, like, oh, like, I am sorry. What did you say? And it's like, dude, where are you from? That was like really, really bad.
Democracy is very different in USA from Kazakhstan. In America, women can vote, but horse cannot.
Vitaly says at first he felt like a Belarusian version of Borat, Sacha Baron Cohen's fictional film Idiot Hero from Kazakhstan. But then something surprising started to happen. While making his pitch to undecided American voters, Vitaly started telling them his own story. It wasn't smooth, but it was genuine. And it worked.
I grew up in a country where nobody asked us. Nobody asked me what president I would love to elect. Nobody even asked me like who I am. Like, nobody cared. And here you have like this democracy. You can like actively voice your opinion and you can actively influence the decision making. And this is actually amazing. And you guys don't understand what you have. So don't give me this like crap about you have no time. If you don't have time today, what about tomorrow? You're like, well, yeah, I have time tomorrow. So, okay, then you have to come. Like, well, I guess yes. You know?
This is the kind of authenticity grassroots campaigns are made of. Soon Vitaly was on his way, promoted out of the basement, and fast forward another election cycle, onto the front line of yet another presidential bid.
Today, with your support and the support of millions of people throughout our country, we begin a political revolution.
That's right, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Vitaly worked as a campaign staffer, or did, until Sanders lost the Democratic nomination to party insider Hillary Clinton. Disappointing, but it taught Vitaly a hard lesson in politics.
The Bernie Sanders campaign, like, I was a little bit idealistic, and then I said, like, okay, if there is a ideal and perfect system on earth that is like democratic and set up to help real people, it has to be American system. But then later I realized that money plays a huge role in politics.
But by this point, Vitaly had become a skilled political operator with a sophisticated understanding of technology's role in grassroots politicking. That proved handy when in 2017 Moscow came calling. Russia's beleaguered opposition, hoping to gain seats in municipal races, tapped Vitaly to help build a creative tech-based campaign. Vitaly's solution, the Uberization of Russian politics. He and a team developed apps that allowed hundreds of opposition candidates to out-organize and beat pro-Kremlin parties in several key districts. And this brings us to the present, and maybe Vitaly's hardest assignment yet. Vitaly now serves as a key advisor to Russian socialite turned candidate, Ksenia Sobchak. She's making a very long shot bid for the Russian presidency in next month's election. Sobchak's candidacy has been dogged by accusations she's a Kremlin-endorsed spoiler to generate voter interest in the election. President Vladimir Putin is widely expected to win outright, in part because Putin's fiercest critic, opposition leader Alexei Navalny, has been barred from the race, and so the Kremlin's real concern seems to be getting enough Russians to show up at the polls. Enter Sobchak. But Vitaly rejects the spoiler charges. He says the important thing is that Sobchak is using her campaign to publicly challenge the Kremlin on a host of issues, including Navalny's ban, that Russians otherwise would not hear about at all.
This election is a fake. So in this type of reality, you don't have much of a choice. Even though you understand you're going to lose, but you can try at least do something for the better future that's going to come not tomorrow, not after election day or whatever. It's going to come probably in 20, 30 years.
And if that idea sounds slightly reminiscent of a staple phrase that Vitaly's political hero often borrowed from his own idol.
You know, Dr. King once said that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
Then maybe that's no surprise. In the arc of Russian politics, Vitaly admits he's a rare optimist. Now, is it the audacity of hope or utter delusion? Well, either way, thanks, Obama. For The World, Charles Maines, Moscow.
Just ahead, growing up with someone else's name. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. A new episode of our podcast, Otherhood, comes out today, and my colleague Rupa Shenoy is here to tell us about it. Hey, Rupa.
Hi, Marco. Do you mind if I start with a question for you?
Yeah, go for it.
When I say the name Nick Dombrowski, who do you visualize?
Nick, it's a man. Nick Dombrowski, it's a white man. And you're not going to believe this, but I know somebody named Dombrowski in Mexico City, so I'm going to say it's a Mexican white man.
Well, I met a guy named Nick Dombrowski a while back. He had sent me an email with a really intriguing subject line. It read, growing up with someone else's name. Huh. He owns a bike shop in L.A.
Like having the name Nick Dombrowski when you, you know, read my email or whatever, you read something about me on a blog, when they meet you in person, it's very apparent, like the people who made very specific judgments based on your name. And like some people I've met in person, I'll go up and like, great to finally meet you, I'm Nick, and they don't even know how to process it. And they just look at you like, what? And and I know, like, they don't have to say anything. Like, I know what they're thinking. I know, like, what's going on in their head. And you're just like, oh, like, you thought you were expecting, like, a 6-foot blonde guy or something. Like,
so Nick doesn't look like what some people would think a guy named Nick Dombrowski would look like.
Right. Nick and his brother were adopted from South Korea and raised outside Pittsburgh. And his whole life, he's had these moments when it's clear that people saw him as different from his family. Like, they'd be out together, his parents, he and his brother, and his two younger sisters, who are biological children of his parents.
So many times we'd all be at dinner, and we're like, we're not teenagers yet. And the servers would ask me and my brother if we were on a separate bill. Like, my parents would be offended. And I still wouldn't really understand what was going on.
And until a few years ago, he was able to brush those times off.
Yeah, so what changed? Hang on. No, let me guess. Politics changed.
Good guess. Yeah, he says with the new national focus on race and identity, especially under Trump, Nick's been thinking more of himself as a person of color, which he didn't always do, being part of a white family.
I was able to really recognize that even though all the people that know me say, like, I'm pretty much white, that's a really disturbing thing to say. And I kind of stopped seeing myself that way because I realized I wasn't being treated that way.
Nick intrigued me so much by saying stuff like that that I wanted to do a whole episode on this. And, you know, Otherhood is about race and identity, and this seemed like a really rich way to look at how things are changing. I started by talking to this author, Adam Pertman, who wrote this book, Adoption Nation, and he says he's been hearing a lot from adoptees of color who are having similar realizations.
Those kids now are becoming much more aware of their race. They feel more stigmatized. They feel more different. They feel more other. And that's not supposed to be the idea. It's your parents' job to help you navigate that. It shouldn't be their job to explain why the President of the United States just said something that's offensive to you. And that's the position those kids and those parents are being put in way too often.
Yeah, so it should be the job of the parents to help out with this, but that assumes that parents are all from the same political spectrum. I mean, families have different political identities and realities, right? How's that playing out?
Yeah, I tried to hit both ends of the political spectrum. I spent time with a family in Connecticut. The parents are liberal and they're white, and they have two daughters, Maya and Milana, and they were adopted from the same orphanage in northern India. Milana is 29, and she's always identified as a person of color, and Maya's 26, and she never has. When Trump was elected president, Milana called Maya and told her she was worried about what Trump's presidency would mean for POCs. And Maya didn't know what POC meant. You're going to hear Maya first, and then Milana.
I Googled it. Because I never really identified myself as a person of color, that was when, like, I realized that I wasn't just a person, but I was also something else that could be affected.
It's like, sometimes that's been hard, I think, in our relationship, because I feel like, how are you not, like, seeing this, or how are you not experiencing things, like, the same way as me? I mean, they wrote, like, the N-word on the wall of the school, like, you know, people yelled things out of cars to me. One time when I was a kid, somebody said they were going to kill me. I also think we probably had certain privileges to be able to assimilate, being a part of a white family, and, like, being Asian, not being black, like, you can kind of go with the flow.
It sounds as if they're coming closer together in the way they see their identity. Am I right?
Yeah. But what I really took away was that this is a very individual experience, both for individual adoptees and families. And they're all navigating this in their own way.
Did you speak with any conservative families about this, Rupa?
Yeah. I reached out to Nancy French, a writer for the conservative magazine National Review, who ghost wrote Sarah and Bristol Palin's books.
Huh.
She and her husband, David French, who also writes for National Review, have two biological children, and then they adopted a third child from Ethiopia. Her name is Naomi. In 2012, David was getting an award at the Conservative Political Action Conference, and they took all the kids up on stage.
So they call us up to accept it, and immediately, and I think it was televised on like CNN or C-SPAN or something, and immediately we start getting all this terrible response from people. People are upset that Republicans are raising a black child. They said that this was cultural genocide, which is ridiculous. Like, she would not have lived. Actually, Sarah Palin came up to me because she saw some of the backlash on the internet. And she goes, you have to promise me that you will never read any of these comments.
Wow. So people were telling her Republicans couldn't raise a black child because they're racist?
Yeah. And Nancy kind of rejected that assumption.
But then if you fast forward a few years, you've got Republicans standing behind a president who says horrible, racially insensitive, polarizing things.
She still doesn't think that average Republicans are racist, but she understands why some people would think so because of Republican enthusiasm for Trump.
Is she still a Republican?
No, actually, you know, and she hasn't really, this hasn't been in the public so much. She and her husband have left the party.
I'm not welcome in either party. And so, like, recently I was out with Naomi, and she saw Donald Trump come up on a TV in the corner of a restaurant. And she says, oh, I do not like Donald Trump. And, you know, there are all these, you know, Tennesseans sitting around eating, you know, eating their sandwiches happily. And so I just sort of, like, brought her into me, and I said, we don't need to talk loudly about politics anymore. This is a different era. I'm not worried about her offending people. I just don't want to draw attention to the fact that we're a white family with a black child in today's political climate.
And I asked her if she would feel the same way about Republicans and Trump if she didn't have a black child.
I don't know that I would have the same deep, you know, feelings if I didn't have Naomi, but I would hope that I would. And my message to conservatives out there is that you should too.
It sounds like a really layered episode of Otherhood, Rupa.
Yeah, there's a lot more in the episode.
I look forward to hearing it. Thanks so much for this preview.
Sure thing, Marco.
Rupa Shenoy is a host of our podcast, Otherhood. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts, including Apple Podcasts. I'm Marco Werman. Violinist Joe Kai was born in South Korea, but grew up in different U.S. cities as his parents moved for work. Now he makes music that draws on a life of diversity.
For me, as an immigrant and as someone who has had so many experiences, I have too many experiences, perhaps.
Joe Kai's story and his music, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It wasn't too long ago that the idea of getting serious amounts of electricity from solar power was pretty much a pipe dream. It was far too expensive, but that picture is changing fast. Costs are coming way down, and over the next 5 years, the amount of solar around the world is expected to grow 10 times. We're not just talking on the roofs of well-off environmentalists. Solar panels are making their way onto modest homes in low-income communities. But the solar boom is also having growing pains, and in some cases getting pushback from utilities. From our Livable Planet desk, The World's Jason Margolis has a story of a growing battle over solar power in Pueblo, Colorado.
When Manny and Roz de la Rosaturi retired from their advertising jobs near Philadelphia, they wanted to explore the United States in their RV. So they got out the map.
We wanted a more central location. We were looking for a more affordable place to live. And we looked at all these AARP best 10 lists, and Pueblo figured in a lot of them.
However, had we known that Pueblo was also one of the highest utility rates, that was one of the top 10s we did not know about when we moved here.
So did you get your first bill, and was it sticker shock?
The electric bills here were about 30 to 40% higher than in the Philadelphia area.
So we are talking about $180 per month average.
How big is this home?
2,500 square feet. And we were living with in one room or two rooms because we couldn't afford to either heat the whole house or have air conditioning in the whole house.
Their utility, Black Hills Energy, had begun charging its Pueblo customers more to pay for a new natural gas power plant east of town. But Pueblo is not a wealthy community. Many customers here couldn't afford the higher bills and had their power cut off. The De Lizarraturis, who met in Manny's native Mexico 35 years ago, were in a better position. They decided to try and avoid those higher bills by installing solar panels on their roof, buying on credit. Today, the panels produce enough electricity to power their entire home. They remain hooked up to the grid, but have cut their power bills dramatically, and now only have one line left on their monthly statement.
Just the connection fee. So,
if that were the end of the story, well, there wouldn't be much of a story. But it's not. Some of the De Lizarraturis' neighbors put up solar panels too, but not enough to provide all of their electricity. And under rate changes Black Hills proposed last summer, these folks would see their electricity rates go up even more. Some solar customers would actually end up paying higher bills than if they had never installed solar in the first place.
I know, it makes like no sense. So for the portion that your solar panels don't cover, you have to buy the electricity from Black Hills. But instead of charging the same rate as everyone else, they were penalizing the solar owners and charging them twice the rate. Or proposing that.
Solar owners felt like Black Hills was trying to punish them. The company says it needed those higher rates to pay for upkeep on the whole electrical system.
It's a plan to look at allocating the costs fairly across all customer groups.
That's Julie Rodriguez, who manages community affairs for Black Hills Energy, which is based in South Dakota. She says everyone who's hooked up to the grid needs to help offset its costs.
And at this point, residential customers without solar panels are paying more than their fair share and subsidizing the solar customers.
Not surprisingly, solar users see it differently.
So they were basically pitting solar owners against the other ratepayers.
So Roz and Manny De Lizarraturi helped form a grassroots group, about 200 people, to fight the proposed rate hikes. And last month, a Colorado judge agreed with them, saying that Black Hills' new rates for its partial solar customers were harsh and dramatically higher than acceptable. That decision still needs final approval by state regulators. Black Hills has targeted home solar users before. A few years back, the company phased out incentives for solar rooftop installation, effectively killing a budding solar industry in Pueblo. Add it all up, the De Lizarraturis and the grassroots movement that bubbled up in Pueblo decided they'd had enough of Black Hills Energy altogether.
They control the generation, the transmission, and the distribution of electrical energy. Rooftop solar is coming in, and investor-owned utilities are looking at this as a threat. So our whole quest now is to change the economic paradigm of the new energy economy.
The local activists joined with the Sierra Club to convince Pueblo's city council to commit to 100% renewable energy by the year 2035. And the council also agreed to look into the possibility of cutting ties with Black Hills and forming its own utility. They're not alone. Other cities have municipal utilities, and more are exploring the idea. But economist Steve Sakala at the University of Chicago says the backlash against utilities may be misguided. For one thing, Sakala says, utility grids really do have fixed costs that need to be shared.
And the people who were putting solar panels on their rooftops were paying less of that.
Sakala says a key service utilities provide is reliability, something that's important for everyone. And becoming a city-owned utility, that's challenging.
For all of the problems that they feel that they're experiencing with the utility, there will be a menu of different problems that they'll experience when they're on their own as a municipal utility.
One of those problems is rooted in solar energy itself. Pueblo is sunny some 260 days a year, but when the sun goes down or it's cloudy outside, solar doesn't do much good. Too much intermittent solar production can also destabilize the grid. Batteries and other kinds of storage can help with both of those problems, but right now they're imperfect and expensive. That's why Pueblo City Council member Bob Schilling voted against the idea of possibly ditching the utility.
That's just crazy.
Schilling was the only dissenter of the seven-member council.
What it came down to was Pueblo doesn't have enough money to pull this off. And when we looked at the cost and the things that you've got to take over, it's just an impossible task. I don't think everybody quite understands the incredible depth how complicated this project would be.
Well, he's going to be proven wrong.
Larry Atencio is Schilling's colleague on the city council. We drove around his precinct, an area where he grew up.
You can see that these neighborhoods are really low income. Yeah, boarded up houses, a lot of vacant lots.
Atencio says the city doesn't have much of a choice here. Many people simply can't afford what he calls Black Hills' exorbitant electricity rates. And he says bringing rate relief goes hand in hand with cutting climate pollution.
I think that the two are so compatible. We can provide low-cost energy to low-income people at the same time not produce emissions that degrade our environment.
Atencio concedes that the path to creating a municipal utility and one that generates 100% clean energy will be very hard. But he says the traditional utility model is already crumbling in the face of technologies like microgrids and inexpensive solar arrays.
Not only that, but individual homeowners will be able to produce their own energy, store it, and become completely independent of the grid. So what are the energy companies going to have to do? They're going to have to learn how to provide that energy at the same cost that the homeowner himself is going to be able to produce it for himself, or they go out of business.
But remember, Pueblo is taking on a $3 billion company and a $6 trillion industry. Fights like the one in Pueblo have also played out in other states, with utilities crushing the solar industry. Still, angry ratepayers in Pueblo point to their victories so far and the fact that hundreds of people from diverse backgrounds have mobilized and come together. And now they have the ear of city and state government and their utility. As for Black Hills Energy, Julie Rodriguez says the company is committed to staying in Pueblo and is willing to explore options to make it work. For The World, Jason Margolis, Pueblo, Colorado.
Pueblo isn't the only city trying to figure out how to support its public grid as more people move to locally generated power supplies. Other cities across the U.S. and around the world are trying to figure out how costs should be split between solar and non-solar customers. To learn more about this, I've got Scott Berger with us in the studio. He's a researcher with the MIT Energy Initiative, where he looks at rate design and solar adoption. So we heard in Jason's story, Scott, that the grid benefits everyone. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Because if you're offline or you have your own solar, how do you actually benefit from the grid?
For all customers, the grid delivers a lot of value by allowing us to tap low-cost resources elsewhere. And allowing customers that can't afford to install solar to benefit from those technologies. In the case of rooftop solar owners, as we all know, the sun only shines during the day, right? So rooftop solar owners, while they might produce enough energy during the daylight hours, they're still consuming electricity from the grid at night. And so the infrastructure that's in place that delivers them power at night is still very valuable for those homeowners.
How are different states, though, and different utilities dealing with how much to charge for whatever energy that you're buying?
This is an issue that, as you mentioned, really utilities all over the world and all over the U.S. are grappling with. Typically, what they try and do is raise maybe a fixed charge or create charges based on your peak demand. So those are typically called demand charges. So those are the typical approaches that utilities are taking.
How is this playing out in other countries, like in Europe, where they've had a longer runway with renewables? Like we know that Germany, for example, is one of the global leaders in the transition to renewables. How have they handled it there?
This is an issue that Germany is struggling with, and I don't think they've yet figured out the solution. So Germany has a slightly different system in the United States. The United States largely relies on a program called net metering, which basically means for every kilowatt hour I produce, I don't pay the retail tariff for that system, or for that kilowatt hour, rather. In Germany, they actually kind of pay you for the amount of energy you produce separately from your own consumption that you pay for the grid. But they're really running into challenges with that right now because actually in Germany, because of some of these investments and decisions they've made, power prices are very high. So power prices in Germany can actually be somewhere on the order of 35 to 40 cents per kilowatt hour or cents per unit of electricity, right? And the average rate, just to give you some context, in the U.S. is about 10 to 12 cents per kilowatt hour.
Right, so that's significant.
So about four times as high as it is here. So what that's actually driving a lot of homeowners to do is install batteries and install rooftop solar systems, et cetera, so that they no longer have to pay for those grid fees.
I mean, but, that problem of intermittency. Yeah. I mean, everybody's kind of facing that, aren't they?
Well, yeah. So the intermittent power, I would say this is an issue that we're learning to understand and accept much better now that we have more, you know, more years of experience with the intermittency of solar and wind. But, you know, the problems of intermittency don't actually become a challenge until you're at maybe 25 to 30, maybe 40% of your total electricity from wind and solar. So,
and is Germany at a point where they are dealing with it and they're looking at big batteries? I mean, what is their answer?
Exactly. They're at that point now. And basically, there's a number of solutions. You can kind of increase the flexibility of the other power plants that are in your system. So, you know, as solar ramps up, you ramp down maybe a natural gas facility or some other plant. And they're also exploring solutions, like you said, like large energy storage facilities or other types of kind of new and novel solutions, like taking electricity and converting that into renewable fuels like hydrogen.
So if renewable customers still have to rely on the grid, have you kind of gotten to a point where you see kind of like the perfect balance between renewable and kind of conventional grid power?
Yeah, so this is kind of the question that we asked when we engaged in this project at MIT called the Utility of the Future. And the solution that we came to is basically we need to move to a system where, you know, my own consumption decisions for electricity or my own production decisions for, you know, producing electricity with rooftop solar, et cetera, map to the costs or value that I'm providing in the system. So if I'm consuming electricity during peak hours where it's really, really expensive, I need to make sure that I'm paying that rate because otherwise my neighbor is paying for it instead of me. And similarly, if I'm producing solar power and that's providing a lot of value to the grid, the utility should be paying for that because that's really creating value. But if I'm producing solar power at a time where it's not really valuable or maybe I'm not really offsetting the cost of the grid, there are ways that we can do it that don't then require my neighbor to pay a higher grid costs so that I can afford to have that solar system. Because in the long run, we need a grid that works for everyone, not just for rooftop solar owners, right? So we need a grid that is really kind of robust and green and efficient and reliable far into the future for all electricity consumers.
Scott Berger with the MIT Energy Initiative. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Before the break, here's a little preview of a story we'll have for you tomorrow. It's about the death of a rebel fighter in British-controlled India in 1857. His body was blown apart in a grisly execution by cannon. His skull would later be displayed at an English pub. Yeah, I said it's gruesome. But recently, that skull was given to a university historian to see what he could learn about the person it was once a part of.
It comes with a responsibility to be handling somebody else's mortal remains. You know, he never imagined that his remnants would still be in existence more than 150 years after these events.
As detective stories go, the beginning was auspicious. Inside the skull was a note explaining that it belonged to a rebel leader who had killed British civilians.
This was arguably the biggest anti-colonial uprising anywhere in the world. And British women and children were killed. And for the British, this was something that really caused outrage.
And outrage layered upon outrage. The rebel, his name was Alam Beg, turns out to have been innocent.
But as far as the British were concerned, that didn't matter much because all Indian men in areas where the outbreak had happened were considered to be guilty.
The Skull of Alam Beg, a life and death story in British-controlled India, tomorrow here on the show. A sad footnote to an incredible story we brought you a couple of months back. Kalman Aaron, born to a Jewish family in Riga, Latvia in 1924, his life literally defined by his talent as an artist. Aaron, I heard from the man who introduced us to his story, died this past weekend at the age of 93. He began drawing and painting at a young age. When World War II broke out, his family was cordoned off in the Jewish ghetto in Riga and then sent to slave labor camps. Aaron survived, he told us, because the guards realized he could paint and draw.
If I didn't have a pencil and paper, I wouldn't be here.
The guards asked Aaron to paint their pictures, draw portraits of their families, and in return they gave Aaron bread or left him off of certain work details. After the war, with $4 in his pocket, Kalman Aaron ended up in Los Angeles. Back in December, we caught up with Kalman Aaron in his home, and he was still painting for one simple reason.
Boredom. I'm still talking. I'm still walking. I couldn't be unhappy if I sit down there and I do something and nobody else has done that. That's what keeps me going.
You can hear that story about Kalman Aaron again, learn more about his incredible life, and see some of his artwork. That's over at PRI.org. We're going to wrap up today talking about looping. It's a pretty cool technology that's become quite widely used. It allows a single musician to record samples on the spot and play them back while playing another melody or rhythm.
The loop machine allows you in any given performance space to record something and then create an array of different sounds over the top of that.
That's violinist Joe Kai. He's based in Portland, Oregon, and he's got a new CD out called Migrants. Looping technology wasn't just a shtick for Joe. It was critical to composing songs about his migrant experience.
I was born in Korea, moved to the U.S. when I was 6 years old, lived in Boston for a couple of years, and then my parents upped us again and moved to Seattle, which is where I was raised. For me, as an immigrant and as someone who has had so many experiences, whether it was going to Garfield High School in Seattle, which was 42% black, 36% white, and 16% Asian, I have too many experiences, perhaps. Take me to a place when I'm fed up. Wine on me, I'm drunk. Brown on me, I'm in a bad funk. Onomatopoeia, yeah, bum, bum. In 10th grade, a good friend of mine gave me an underground hip-hop mixtape with groups from Philly, like Lewis Logic and New York and Mos Def. And I realized this is so beautiful. It's so direct, and it stands very intentionally apart from the paradigm of Western music that I had grown up with as a classical musician. By junior year of high school, I was really hungry to express not only the music that had been written by dead white men 500 years ago. Granted, I love Ravel, I love Tchaikovsky, and they have taught me so much about myself and the expression of emotion. But junior year was right around when I realized I needed to sneak off to Blues Club and jam and learn what some of these disparate roots of American music were. What is love in the world of pixels? Swipe left, right, shot down like missiles. The game is crazy. We got so lazy that we raised our profiles more than babies. And so having the looping machine allows me to manifest a lot of those diverse experiences. Whether it is hip-hop, classical music, or jazz, I can access the emotion of a song through the different vocabularies that I find most authentic to myself. Couple months past, you're in my conscience. Couple drinks until I'm unconscious. I'm like a prodigal searching for pot of gold. I'm a suede rainbow right until I vomit. Take me to your place when I'm messed up. I need to fess up. I need an exorcism. My system broke. So what I'm trying to do in Fall In is to unlock and share in some of those musical ideas. Communication will forever be key. Separation of communities that need to bridge the gap. I wonder if my path will lead me to a soulmate that remembers me. Or can I be deleted like another app? Already know the answer, gotta face the fact that relationships take patience and value. So many wanna love, but they don't know. There's another song on the album called Joseph Ress's Head.
If you'd stay and tell me why I am here with you.
I was given the name Joseph when I moved here, and Joseph is one of the first immigrant stories that we have in the writings of all the Abrahamic religions. Joseph, if I may, he leaves his homeland of Canaan, is sent to communicate a message to his brothers who happen to be out, with their sheep and grazing. He ends up, of course, Joseph ends up in Egypt, this very well-established country with lucrative opportunities. But there's a moment in time when he's betrayed by his brothers and he has been cast off and is lying at the bottom of this pit as his brothers try to figure out what to do with him. Should we kill him? Should we... What should we do with him?
And that's where I often feel my identity is, in this liminal space in between countries. When my parents were here in America and our whole family was here, it was easier to assign home a clearer geographic location. In that case, it was Seattle, where I still think most of my roots lie. But when they moved back in 2008, when they realized that getting a job as a older Asian American man in academia with, and of course having an Asian accent, it was really hard for myself. It was really hard for my sister, because we had spent our lives trying to fit into this country with every ounce of our energy. How can we assimilate? How can we be accepted by our peers as fellows and not others? So when they moved back, it was really hard to then continue to send them off. The geographic distance is fixed, but I often feel like my parents are kind of on an iceberg, and you know, it's a bad Gary Larson cartoon where they're slowly floating away, because culturally and linguistically, the distance between myself and my parents continues to grow.
Jokai's new CD is titled Migrants. Recorded or live, Jokai is worth checking out. He's also got a pretty good sense of humor, as I learned when I saw him perform live. And we'll leave it there today. I'm Marco Werman, and the world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.